There's a few diseases where you sort of get lulled into a false sense of security, and you have a few cases that are really straightforward and you think you're all over them and they respond beautifully to treatment and go home looking $1 million. And then you get one that just crashes and burns, throw every drug at them, or multiple transfusions, every immunosuppressive you can think of, antithrombotics, and then they crash and burn.
Hi, I'm Hubert.
This is Gerardo.
Hi, I'm Dave Collins. I'm a small animal medicine specialist who works in the north of Sydney. I've been enjoying doing some podcasts with Hubert and Gerardo. I also like to ski and bike and surf as much as I can. And once COVID-19's over, I'd love to get you all on my veterinary conferences as well.
And you are listening to the VetWelt Clinical Podcast. Hello, VetWelters, and thank you for joining us again. We thought that we'd give you a sneak preview of our upcoming clinical podcasts with this episode on the diagnosis of immune-mediated hemolytic anemia. IMHA is one of those diseases where timely recognition and treatment can mean the difference between a patient that lives and one that does not. But it can be challenging to diagnose. So we've partnered with Dr. Dave Collins, who is a medicine specialist from Northside Vet Specialist in Sydney, to help you create a plan for diagnosing and saving these patients. This episode is the first of a three-part series on IMHA. The other two will be available on the VetWelt Clinical Medicine Podcasts as soon as we release it. Head to thevetwelt.com and subscribe to our email list, and we will send you the summarized notes for this episode and let you know when the podcasts go live.
We've also partnered again with our friends at Heska Australia. Heska is the best thing that's happened to the in-house laboratory industry in Australia in a very long time. Check out all their cool diagnostic tools at heska.com.au and make sure you look at their Reset program to see how you can get all of their top-of-the-range in-house lab equipment for free. If you click on the link in the show description, that's there, heska.com.au/VetVault1, and give them your details. They will send you the most up-to-date consensus statement for the diagnosis of IMHA. This includes all the details of pretty much everything anyone needs to know about how to diagnose these difficult cases. Now, back to Dave and how to diagnose IMHA.
Dave, thank you for joining us for this clinical episode on IMHA.
No worries. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Now, this is a topic that I think is important to talk about, immune-mediated hemolytic anemia. It's one of those that sometimes I find quite straightforward, and other times it's a real bastard. It really can blindside you. I remember I spent a couple of years working in the UK in a smallish practice in Wales, and we saw a lot of it there. I don't know if it was the breeds we saw, but we tended to see a lot. It was early in my career, and my first few cases went really well. So I was under the impression, you know, either I'm really good at this or it's not such a bad disease to treat. And then I specifically remember I remember the case really well. Beautiful male Doberman, and came in, diagnosed him quickly, got him on what I thought was the right treatment, and he just went to total crap. Just fell apart within a day. He was critical. We weren't set up for high level critical care, and he was dead within almost 24 hours. And that gave me a big fright, that case. And subsequently, I often find them really challenging these days instead of those nice, easy ones. So I'd love to have your thoughts on what are the challenges with this? Why can they be so difficult?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, I was just talking to someone the other day who had a really bad case, and there's a few diseases where you sort of get lulled into a false sense of security. Pancreatitis is probably another one. You have a few cases that are really straightforward and you think you're all over them and they respond beautifully to treatment and go home looking $1 million. And then you get one that just crashes and burns, throw every drug at them. You know, IMHA, for example, multiple transfusions, every immunosuppressive you can think of, antithrombotics, and then they crash and burn. They need transfusion after transfusion. They turn bright yellow and despite your best efforts. But it's really important disease. It's really common. It's probably the most common immune-mediated disease, certainly that I see. And I think establishing the diagnosis is really important as well. And, you know, recognizing anemia and the significance of regenerative anemia, but also the difficulty and the limitations of identifying anemia, given that it'll sometimes take up to 5 days to develop. Some non-regenerative IMHAs, you know, you'll never get a decent reticulocyte response because the immune system's knocking off the reticulocytes before they come into the bone marrow.
That's a fun one for you, hey?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, it's one of the things you need to jump on is regeneration. Is it hemorrhage? Is it hemolysis? And even some of these occult blood bleeds are really difficult to rule out. Well, some of the treatment aids I get is because the diagnosis isn't quite right. All the PRED in the world isn't going to help, like a zinc toxicity, for example.
You talk about diagnosis being a challenge, right? But then also like diagnosis of the, you know, the search for this underlying cause, this trigger, that kind of thing. I find that difficult too. And yeah, I got a question, but it's probably going to throw you off track a little bit, but do you see like a seasonality to IMHA?
Not really. There's been some Northern Hemisphere studies that have detected seasonality, and whether that's sort of environmental or parasites or infections or whatever, it's hard to know. There's a study from Victoria about 10 years ago which also found no effect of seasonality either. I guess all of us are sort of in an emergency or a referral setting, so our population's a bit skewed or biased, but I pretty much seem to see them all year round. And like a lot of diseases, you don't see one for ages and then you see three all at once, but we haven't really identified a season. There's just so many studies trying to identify, you know, causality, you know, vaccines, for example, and, you know, there's temporal associations and statistical methods. I have no idea how they do to determine, rule things in or out, but none, it's definitively established things is super difficult.
Okay, so that leads us to causes. Are there, because clients will always ask, well, what caused this? Why has it got it? Have we got a list of common causes for it?
We've got lists that have been reported in a lot of studies over the years and various things that we used to think cause them, like a few drugs, a few cancers, inflammatory disease, infectious disease, and yet the recent consensus statement from the American College of Internal Medicine said, you know, the evidence is really, really poor. The only real disease with a high degree of evidence are some infections such as the mycoplasmas in cats, haemophilus, which frustratingly is not a huge thing in Australia anyway, whereas other things like FELV, FIV in cats, even FIP have been associated, but there's not a huge degree of evidence. Cancers, you know, you've got to think there can be any inflammatory, infectious or neoplastic condition. So, Gerardo, back to your previous question, certainly looking for an underlying cause is important and may well be a trigger. However, the evidence is not strong. But the other way look at it is also that, you know, if you've got a devastating cancer, then, you know, this dog's not got a long outlook anyway. So, you know, it may not be worth spending hundreds or thousands of dollars, as the case may be, to try and treat the dog. So traditionally, myelo or lymphoproliferative neoplasias like leukemia and lymphoma, some soft tissue sarcomas and carcinomas have been associated. But again, the evidence from the consensus is not huge. Pancreatitis, I've often thought, can be associated. I certainly don't know whether it's a cause or an effect. You know, if you've got a poorly perfused or oxygenated pancreas, it's going to get pretty angry at times. So maybe it's an effect rather than a cause. And again, there's a few drugs like antibiotics and things as well that have been associated over the years. Even bee stings, you know, snake bites, probably a different etiology, but they're all things you need to think about with and presented with hemolysis.
Mm. And you mentioned vaccines earlier. Is there any evidence that links it?
No.
Okay, simple answer. No. Okay.
Well, look, there's been a lot of work done about you know, causality and temporal associations. And while they're sort of talking about primary and secondary IMHA being true autoimmune versus, you know, secondary to another disease, and the consensus was sort of wanting to go away from that and go to associative and non-associative IMHA. So saying that IMHA is associated with vaccines, associated with drugs, associated with lung tumours. But whilst a lot of people are suspicious of vaccines causing it, and no doubt you want to get an immune response from your vaccine, but it the evidence pointing to it being a definitive cause of IMHA is quite poor. It's difficult trying to convince anti-vaxxers on the strength of evidence, but but that's there's little evidence.
A little side stream. I was interested the other day to see an article that there was we had our first case of ehrlichiosis in Australia recently up in northern WA. Now in South Africa, we saw lots of the ehrlichiosis and then babesiosis, and those guys definitely. I don't know. Is it certainly yes. What we were taught is there's a trigger for an IMHA if you ever wanted one.
Absolutely, yeah. I sort of ignored them to some extent because we don't really see them, but yeah. But absolutely, ehrlichiosis and babesia. There's actually strong evidence.
Let's go back to picking these up, to spotting them. So you're in your GP clinic and you have a sick dog coming in and you do a basic bloods and it's anemic. How are we going to, what's going to make you think IMHA versus I should be digging for another cause?
I guess the basic workup's going to be PCV, TP, blood smear, test for autoagglutination, and based on that, you should be trying to identify regenerative anemia. Blood smear examination is probably really, really important for people to get used to, and a lot of people don't have the time, but if you can just get used to looking at a whole bunch of blood smears, you can get used to recognizing normal and abnormal pretty quickly. I was going to say the new methylene blue stain is what you need to identify the DNA of reticulocytes, which is not in most clinics. So it can be tricky to pick up the reticulocytes. A CBC can be done in most clinics. You probably need one of the newer machines to identify reticulocytes, some degree of accuracy. You can't really identify it in most clinics on a blood smear, but if you can identify a regenerative response, which may not be there for 2 to 5 days, that can be pre-regenerative for that amount of time. They can stay non-regenerative if the reticulocytes are getting taken out, so they're kind of pitfalls. But I guess signs on a blood smear you're looking for are spherocytes. They're smaller, rounder, more red erythrocytes than the others. They're lacking the central pallor. That can be common in other diseases too, even stored blood. So it's important not to look at or to try and get your samples before your blood transfusion. They talked about seeing at least 3 to 5 spherocytes per high power field. The more you see, the more likely you're dealing with IMHA and not some other cause. Polychromasia is another indication of generation in that you've got a range of sizes or colours of the red blood cells, and nucleated red blood cells are also an important feature to look for. I don't want to bore everyone with different terms of red blood cells and things, but you might be able to pick up other sorts of red blood cells such as schistocytes, which are little fragments of red blood cells which might be left over if you've got something like DIC or heartworm or hemangiosarcoma. And there's a lot of good atlases there that clinics might have by the microscope to kind of help identify weird kind of cells. And there's pretty readily available cameras you can stick on the end of microscopes these days to take some happy snaps and send them to your pathologist friends to to identify, or even the discussion groups, on Facebook and stuff might help you out. So the really important thing, and I guess the pitfalls that we see sometimes, are that people haven't identified spherocytes and also haven't looked for autoagglutination. Hopefully you guys and a lot of emergency clinicians or first opinion vet are used to kind of doing this test, but a drop of blood may well show autoagglutination, but you've also got to distinguish from rouleau, which is just the stacking of the red blood cells. So the way to kind of distinguish that is the saline autoagglutination. And the technique that's well established now is 4 drops of saline, which will disperse your rouleau, but autoagglutination will stay there. So you need to give it a couple of minutes to settle. But if you've got a drop of blood, 4 drops of saline, and still got clumping of the red cells, then that's a positive autoagglutination test. So,
and your drop of blood straight from the dog, not
EDTA, sorry.
EDTA blood, okay.
EDTA, yep. So you either need spherocytes, autoagglutination, ideally both, and you don't always get autoagglutination. It's only about 50%, maybe higher, of cases that you can demonstrate it. The other thing you would need to do otherwise is a Coombs test. So that's you looking for anti-erythrocyte antibodies, which you can send off to the lab. There's more fancy techniques such as flow cytometry that can be available. The sensitivity is about 80% in dogs, so it's not always positive anyway, but the specificity is quite good, with the exception of cases that have already been given steroids. So, you know, very important to send off samples, ideally before treatment. You know, like a lot of diseases, if you can hold off steroids, if at all possible, to establish diagnosis.
I don't think I've ever done a Coombs test ever, because, like, when we get them in emergency, we get these pale dogs, and it's like blood smear, CBC and so forth, but blood smear and slight agglutination. And then it's kind of, that's it, right? And you kind of get it and you're done, you manage it. But having said that, you know, like, just because I really never had the opportunity to follow through the case, so I never really done a Coombs test. I know it's there, but I never really do it. Like, how often would you do those?
Yeah, that's a good point. If you've got autoagglutination, you don't need to do a Coombs. You know, it's the same thing. Yeah, I feel for you guys sometimes when you're kind of heavily invested in saving a patient's life and you get the diagnosis and then you've got no idea what's happened to the case. And as I said, about 50% of them a positive autoagglutination, so there's no need to do the Coombs test. But the rest of the cases, particularly if the spherocytes are difficult to identify, then I think a Coombs can be very helpful.
We're going to take a quick detour to talk about the reliability of your in-house diagnostics. Dave's talking about how important it is to accurately identify regenerative changes on your blood samples when you're working up cases of anemia. Now, one thing you don't want to have to worry about when you're struggling with an already complicated case like an IMHA is whether your in-house machine is giving you reliable results or missing subtle changes. So, I thought this would be a great place to put in a plug for our podcast partner, Heska Australia. So I got Dr. Justin Chu on the line to sell him on my clever marketing idea. I told him that we could tell you all about how you don't have to worry about reliability if you're using Heska's flagship hematology analyzer, the Element HD5. Because of how its accuracy has been extensively checked against all the other leading machines on the market and by a bunch of very pedantic pathologists. And that we should tell you how the HD5 uses not just one, but three separate technologies to ensure that the results are accurate. It's a quick aside here. I won't bore you with the technical details, but it's actually pretty cool. If you're a bit of a tech geek, you should check out the videos about it at Heska's website. It has freaking lasers. Then I said that we should tell you that all you have to do is chuck 15 micromills of blood into the machine, because that's how much you need to get results with the HD5, which is about the volume of the tears of a bee, if bees ever cried. And in under 60 seconds, you will have your reliable results. But then Justin said,
Wait. You know, there's no point having the best hematology analyzer there if you actually don't handle your samples correctly. And let's face it, I've been guilty of this, right? When I graduated, no one detailed to me how to take a sample. I was the vet that would actually take a sample and send a clotted sample to the reference lab, let alone running something in-house, and would always just blame the lab for sending me a result that's non-interpreted or clotted. And it was actually my fault, right? And until I started this role, I didn't really appreciate how important it is to get a good sample. As they say, right, in technology, garbage in, garbage out. If you have a bad sample, you actually have possibly inaccurate results, which will obviously send you down the rabbit hole when it comes to a diagnostic process.
So there's no point having the best machine in the world if I'm not handling my blood right.
Absolutely. Every time I install an analyzer, I'm surprised by how little care that's taken into collecting a sample. The majority of problems actually comes down to sample handling rather than the quality and the accuracy of the analyzer.
Okay, now you've got me worried. Give me the most common things that you think that I'm probably doing wrong in my sample handling.
Yeah, so number one, we tend to always try to use the smallest needle as possible, right? Well, we recommend a 22 gauge or larger, depending on how much the patient tolerates. This is to minimize hemolysis and also to prevent microclot formation.
So bigger needle, better needle.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
What color is 22?
Black.
Black or bigger.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's one.
So that's one. The second thing is not putting your sample directly into the tubes quickly enough, right? Again, want to minimize microclotting. And number three, one mistake that I see all the time is not removing the needle from the syringe.
So number three, take the needle off.
Yes. Yeah. Again, to minimize hemolysis, right?
Yeah,
just want to reduce the risk of it. Yep.
Okay.
Number four would be not to fill the tube up at least halfway. Ideally to the top, right? Because these anticoagulants, EDTA or lithium heparin that we use most commonly, you need to mix it to the right ratios.
Yeah.
Okay. So number five, it's the order. And, you know, we don't think about it, right? We just sort of put whatever order that's in our hand or what the nurses hand over to us.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a correct order and we can actually drill down on why specifically if we need to. But typically the correct order is number one, if you're doing a blood culture, that goes first,
mm-hmm.
followed by a sodium citrate tube for clotting, followed by a plain tube or a clot activated tube for serum,
mm-hmm.
followed by a lithium heparin tube for running on your in-house biochemistry analyzer. Number five, then you put in your EDTA tube for hematology. And lastly, if you're doing glucose testing, especially delayed, you put in your sodium fluoride or potassium oxalate tube.
So why is EDTA number five? You think that the delay is going to cause a little clutch. Surely you want to get your CBC into the EDTA quickly.
Yeah, good point. Really, it's because EDTA is a chelator. So it chelates calcium, especially, you know, we're not particularly careful, especially if we're rushing, that we may do some cross-contamination. So not only if you did your EDTA first and then put in your lithium heparin, you get a low calcium level.
Mm-hmm.
And you also get an increased potassium level because, you know, these tubes are actually potassium EDTA.
So that's if you touch your needle or your syringe.
Yeah,
If you get any EDTA contamination of your...
That's right, that's right. Syringe. I mean, yeah, if you're careful, then sure, it probably doesn't matter so much. But, you know, we're not that careful at the end of the day.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
And then the last thing would be that we don't mix the sample adequately. Obviously, we do it once we put the sample into the tubes, but then we don't mix it again carefully for a hematology sample, right?
Okay.
And so rather than get a full count, we get a partial count. So I guess another point I'd like to bring up is that we would always recommend doing a few blood smears straight out of the patient, right? Whatever's left in that syringe. After you've aspirated into your tubes, just do a couple of blood smears, right? Now, you may not actually need to stain it or look under the microscope, but certainly if you do send it off or if you do look at it later, the cells will look the best straight out of the patient.
Okay. So if you say straight out of the patient, not even out of the EDTA straight away, just before you even go to EDTA, just put a drop on a smear, on a slide, and smear it out.
That's right. That's cool. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. You're right. There's several of those that I'm not all that particular about. And I can guarantee you from working in several practices that I've seen exactly that happen where they're not handled correctly. So that could make a big difference. Justin, thank you so much. That was really helpful and really valuable.
My pleasure. Anytime.
So there you go. Remember that Heska's machines will cost you a grand total of $0. That's Australian dollars, US dollars, Canadian dollars, and even Zimbabwean dollars to buy and install. You just pay for your consumables. I know it sounds too good to be true, but you can call Justin and ask him yourself. Go to heska.com.au to find out more. Now, let's get back to Dave and IMHA.
And the main reason is because there are other causes of hemolysis. There's snakes such as red-bellied blacks over this side of the country. I don't know what we've got in WA here, but hemolysis is really common in black snakes over here. You know, even bee stings can cause it. The low phosphates are a good one in cats. If you're too aggressive with the insulin, and the low phosphate can drive hemolysis. The microangiopathic and schistocytes we've talked about. Congenital things in beagles like pyruvate kinase and phosphofructokinase kinase deficiency. Beagles, Marlies and Abyssinians are the breeds you think of, usually younger. And the other one that can be real tricky is zinc sometimes. So radiographs can, I don't know if you guys have seen a zinc hemolysis, but thoracic radiographs are great for looking for underlying disease. But if you can kind of sneak a bit of abdomen in there and see a metallic foreign body in a hemolyzed patient, then maybe you've got zinc toxicity rather than IMHA.
We had a severe IMHA, I think, with two of them. One was an owner trying to manage a large wound at home with human creams.
Yeah, right.
And it was high levels of zinc in it, and it actually developed IMHA.
Okay, hang on. So is that IMHA or is that without the immune component?
Well, that'd be hemolysis, sorry.
Hemolysis, non-immune mediated hemolytic diseases. Interesting.
Yes. So that can be the pitfall in some of these cases. And the classic one I can remember is a dog that had this weird, well, it ended up being a earring that looked like a pirate, and it was a daughter's earring that the dog had eaten, and it was full of zinc, and the dog was hemolyzing like crazy. So the diagnosis of that, probably the most common or most difficult cases I get are really occult hemorrhage, so GI in particular. So there's some really important clues to look out for to recognise hemorrhage as well. One is the protein level should be lower, whereas IMHA, they tend to be pretty normal or even increased. Globulins, if they're up, that can actually push the protein up, as can dehydration. So the protein levels are really important to look at. Either your TP, and remember things like fat in the blood can distort your TP. So an albumin and globulin reading on your biochem machine can be really helpful.
Cool.
The other really important thing people neglect to look at is red cell indices. And I think as soon as I say that, most people's eyes glaze over, but they can they can give you some really good clues. So low MCV and MCH, corpuscular volume and hemoglobin, is if they're down, if the protein's down and you've got a pretty poor regenerative response, you may actually be dealing with a blood loss, chronic blood loss, maybe even an iron deficiency. And GI bleeds are the classic for that. And I guess general, if you've got a coagulopathy or thrombocytopenia, if you've got any epistaxis, hemoptysis and hematochezia, and a whole lot of words that start with heme, but any source of blood loss, then you obviously need to hunt for a source of bleeding or a coagulopathy. And you guys, I'm sure you guys employ AFAST and TFAST, just looking for bits of fluid. It's important to look at the urine and do a rectal, looking for melena as well, just to give you any clues that you actually need to do a hunt for an occult bleed. And believe me, that can be an absolute nightmare to diagnose sometimes. And some of these cases have already been smacked with steroids before they get to referral. So which is pretty reasonable sometimes, because I think it's pretty common IMHA. So
a quick question from a clinical perspective to get us in the right direction. In my head, I'm almost always going to associate an IMHA with a strong inflammatory response, which normally presents with a pyrexia. If I have a non-pyrexic anemic dog, I'm going to be thinking less, or let's say not just pyrexia, but other indexes of inflammation. So white blood cell count, and this could be a completely side topic, but we've started using CRP in dogs quite a bit as an index of inflammation, to go, well, there's no inflammatory response, it's anemic, it's a hell of a lot less likely to be IMHA. I want to know, how does the logic stack up with that? And then the other thing is, just when you spin those blood samples, just the serum color. So red serum, yellow serum. Yes. If it's hemolytic, it's hemolytic. If it's not hemolytic, well, it's bleeding somewhere. Does that make sense in principle?
It does. Yeah. Look, it's not going to catch all, and you're going to get some slipping through the nets there. Not all of them are pyrexic. I think only about 50%. A lot of them will actually have an inflammatory leukogram or some kind of leukocytosis, but not all. Annoyingly, a lot of patients with inflammatory disease don't have fevers or inflammatory leukograms, but you know, I agree with you, a lot of these cases are crazy inflammatories. They think some of the massive neutrophilias are actually due to hepatic necrosis from hypoxemia of the liver, and necrosis causes an incredible inflammatory and neutrophilic response. So, and that also will often be the reason the ALT is up as well, just through hypoxemic liver damage.
It's a sensitive little suck of the liver, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so demanding for the flow of oxygen. It's about as the brain. God.
Yeah.
And CRP, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, look, if you've got no CRP elevation, then it's pretty hard to imagine that you've got what is usually a markedly inflammatory disease like IMHA going on.
Yeah.
If it's positive, you know, I think it can still be a million things.
Yeah, of course.
That cause inflammation, you know, including pancreatitis, and I think CRP comes into its own when you're serially measuring it.
Mm.
With regard to, I guess also, I don't know how into lactate you guys are, but you know, like a lot of diseases, you know, higher lactates, you know, indicate poorer perfusion and poorer prognosis. So,
yeah.
And the colour of the serum, yeah, absolutely. Nearly all of these have got high bilirubin. With the higher the bilirubin, often associated with a poorer prognosis. It usually means they're extravascular because the red cells have been processed by the mononuclear phagocytic system in the spleen, whereas hemoglobinemia will cause a red serum and sometimes hemoglobinuria as well.
Okay.
So certainly very important clues to the identification of hemolysis, as you say.
So let's flip it around. I know specialists never like to say always. I'm learning that very quickly. but if you don't have yellow or pink serum, can you say very unlikely to be immune mediated?
I don't think I've said always my whole career, but it makes it a hell of a lot less likely.
Okay.
Intravascular only, 30% of the cases, most of them are extravascular. If you've got you can get quite low-grade rumbling cases, which hemolyze but don't overwhelm the liver and the conjugating capacity of the liver. It's hard to imagine no bilirubin elevation. Bilirubin's elevated in, I think, 90% of cases, but you may not get enough to become icteric. That patients aren't icteric till the bilirubin's at least 30 or 40.
Mm.
So you can get, even early in the disease, or if they're just a low grade, you may not get icterus identified.
Awesome.
Let's just recap a little bit. So blood smear, sericytes, and autoagglutination, wham, bam, positive.
Yep. Okay. Straightforward.
But to go further than that, so that you might direct your diagnostics towards identifying potential primary causes or something like that, on a primary, secondary causes, right? The otherwise, if you still think it's IMHA and just your autoagglutination is negative and stuff, then the next step would be Coombs.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I've learned here of value is just because it's an hemolyzing anemia doesn't mean it's immune mediated. So if you don't have that autoagglutination and the spherocytes, don't whack it with steroids straight away. Consider that it could be zinc or one of the other things you listed.
Yeah, look, I think if it's, you know, it's critical and you need to treat them and get steroids, and if you've made a really good effort to rule out other causes of hemolysis, I don't think it's unreasonable to do so. You've got to think about the gut health and things like that, but you've just got to keep in your mind that it's, and that's what I encourage clinicians to do, is it's not wrong to go down one pathway, but you need to at least have considered that there's an alternative.
Awesome. So Dave, you mentioned earlier when we talked about big serum versus yellow serum, we mentioned intravascular versus extravascular hemolysis. Mm-hmm. That's something that I've always struggled with a little bit, the relevance of it and the percentages. Do you want to run us through that?
Yeah, so it's not as common intravascular. It's more, intravascular lysis and more complement-mediated lysis. membrane attack complex lysis, you know, the pathology days coming back. It's only about 30% of cases that are intravascular. You should have hemoglobinemia or hemoglobinuria. An important thing with urine is to distinguish from hematuria rather than hemoglobinemia, so you need to spin it down. Traditionally, all the studies used to put the fear of God into us about intravascular hemolysis. They're really serious, you're treated really aggressively, and personally, I've struggled to let go of that. I tend to agree that you need to not muck around with these guys all up and jump in with more than one immunosuppressive, which we'll talk about another day, but the traditional prognosis was worse with intravascular, and now that more and more studies have been done, it's not bearing out as truthfully. So they tend to do almost as well as the extravascular. It's a little bit like the T-cell and B-cell lymphoma scenario. They used to think one was a hell of a lot worse than the other. But while intravascular is very important to identify, it also makes the diagnosis of IMHA important. It probably does need to be treated more seriously, but the survival times are turning out to be relatively similar.
Okay. And was there anything else you wanted to add? Did you start saying something about pitfalls, Dave?
I guess the pitfalls of protein levels that I was referring to in particular are, given the massive inflammatory response of IMHA, you've often got a really high globulin count. So that's going to push up your TPP. And I guess also if you've got a tumour like a multiple myeloma, you're also going to get a ridiculous protein level, which isn't going to help identify hemolysis or hemorrhage. So there's just a few little things that you need to put into consideration.
It's never straightforward, is it?
Nothing straightforward.
just going back to the extravascular aspect, is there anything else that we could add there?
In general, your extravasculars will be icteric from the outset and have high bilirubin levels. Your intravasculars may not be icteric yet and just have hemoglobinemia, but given enough time for everything to go through the liver to process everything, they will also become icteric. So you probably can't draw any helpful guidelines, I don't think.
And still directly autoagglutinate and so forth. And
yeah, so still you've got to go back to spherocytes or an autoagglutination and Coombs to establish the diagnosis.
Okay, cool. All right. Thank you so much for that, Dave. We'll catch up next time about treatment. How do we manage these guys successfully? We'll talk about prognosis and other things. I think that's a really, really great start to IMHA. Thanks again.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope you found value in that and that you will join us for part 2, which will be all about what's new and what works in the treatment of IMHA. Remember to go to thevetvault.com to register for our email list so we can send you the summarized notes for this episode and so we can let you know when the clinical episodes drop. And don't forget to click on the link to the Heska page in the episode description wherever you are listening to this to get access to the consensus statements on diagnosing IMHA, which has all the details on everything you need to know about IMHA. Have a great week and we'll see you next time.